Thank you, Bob, for this gracious introduction. See? Let's start with just an illustration, a story about a man you may know of him, City Stud, Charles Thomas Stud, born 1860, lived till 1931. He was part of what was called the Cambridge Seven, who spent their, who at the turn of the 20th century, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, seven of the best men of the British Empire. They were up and coming, young men. And C.T. Studd was first, among them. He spent his life, serving Christ first in China and under, Hudson Taylor's China Inland Mission and later in Africa. But before that, he was known as the premier cricket player in England. Now, my wife and I, you know, we subscribe to BritBox and we watch a lot of the British, mysteries. And in a lot of them, you know, the game of cricket, you know, is prominent. Now, I know nothing of cricket. I've seen them just play on those mystery shows a little bit, and it made no sense, you know, to me at all. But cricket at that time, and still is, you know, for the nations that were part of the British Empire, you know, certainly England and Australia, New Zealand. It's really, really big in India, too. So C.C. Studd was the equivalent of the Heisman Trophy winner for cricket. And he could have made a fortune, you know, just playing, you know, cricket, but also he was the son of a rather prominent family, a very, rich family and in England. But he and those others, you know, left all of the fame and fortune to serve, Christ. While he was in China, City Stud's father died, and he got an inheritance of £29,000. That doesn't sound like much, you know, today. And in fact, I sent my, you know, my manuscript some time ago to Bob, and Bob was intrigued by that. I had never looked up what was the equivalent of £25,000, but he did, and he kind of emailed me back and said that was about $5 million at the time. A great sum of money. And he, C.T. Studd, gave it all away. He gave $5,000 to be used for the Moody Bible Institute, £5,000 for George Mueller's mission work to the orphans. That's $1 million, you know, each. £5,000 for George Holland's work with the England's poor in Whitechapel. $5,000 to the Salvation Army, which at that time tended to be more evangelical, too. He and his wife named the first of four daughters Salvation Faith Grace Stud. And he went on to write a poem. And you might be familiar with one of the lines of the poem, but probably not knowing that it was a poem written by C.T. Studd. And I'll give you the line in a moment, some introductory verses to it. But it's actually a rather long poem. I'm just going to use a little bit of it at the beginning of the message, a little bit of it at the end, too. But this is how he began. Two little lines I heard one day, traveling along life's busy way, bringing conviction to my heart, and from my mind will not depart. Only one life, 'twill soon be past. How does that end? Only what's done for Christ will last. Yeah, you know it. Now, I could not find any statements by C.T. Studd suggested that he was fully informed on a focused, you know, free grace position. But however, his poem does suggest that he did believe in the doctrine of eternal rewards. And from the way he named his first daughter, you know, salvation, grace, faith, you know, it's probably an inclination of where he was as well. But he gave his fortune and fame and prestige and lived fully for Christ. He spent a good bit of his life, his last days, up to his last days in Africa, working in very, you know, humble, this was his office, you know, little desk, you know, stacked with books and everything. He could have been a professional cricket player. He could, and this is one of the lines that Bob wrote me back in that email, he could perhaps have been the prime minister, you know, of England. But he became instead a choice servant of the Lord. Since we only have one life, it is crucial that we make the right decisions in how we spend that life. You know, if we give our lives for things that account for little in the life to come, then our lives here on earth will have little value. If on the other hand, we spend our lives on things that last forever, well, God's word, our impact, you know, on people's lives, then our earthly lives will still speak and resound, you know, in heaven. It lasts forever. The greatest use of a life is to spend it for that which will last forever. And that's what Peter had in mind, I think, in writing this letter. He was keenly interested that those he was writing to, and ultimately we as well, we make our lives count forever. The controlling purpose of this great letter of 1 Peter is found in chapter 1, verse 9. And all the speakers that have preceded me all have kind of started in talking about this one little verse as being the controlling purpose of the letter. Verse 9, receiving the end of your faith, the salvation of your souls. It's crucial to understand this phrase, and that's why I'm beginning with it first, and then certainly we'll work through the passage from beginning at chapter 3 on through verse 12 as well. But what did Peter mean by this phrase? He was influenced, as many have pointed out already, by the teaching of Jesus on the matter. Jesus talked frequently about saving our soul, our life, delivering our lives. We find it in Matthew 10, verse 39, Matthew 16, 24 to 27, Mark 8, 34 to 38, Luke 9, 24 to 26, and John 12, 25. And since every gospel there. But perhaps for our purpose, the best of the passages for us to consider will be Mark chapter 8, verses 34 through 38. Let me read it through as you follow along. When he, Jesus, had called the people to himself, with his disciples also, he said to them, "Whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation," of course, many have commented that applies certainly, you know, to our times, of him the Son of Man also will be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. Now, one thing that is immediately evident is that these are not verses on how to obtain everlasting life. If this were so, you know, the conditions would be self-denial, cross-bearing, following Christ, losing one's life for the gospel's sake. The sole condition, of course, for obtaining everlasting life is believing the promise of Jesus for it. But since Jesus is not referring to getting eternal life in these verses in Mark and the other passages that I cited, then from what will our lives or souls be saved? Jesus was talking about being saved from a profitless life, a life that is of no everlasting value. The believer who uses his life to simply pursue the pleasures, the possessions of this world, will take hold of nothing that has everlasting value. Even if he gains the whole world, he will not have an ounce of everlasting gain. The accomplishment of the pursuits of his life will be reduced to ashes at the judgment seat of Christ. Though, as we know, though he himself will be saved, but yet as through fire, 1 Corinthians 3:12 to 15. So Jesus was telling us in these verses how to save ourselves from the everlasting poor investment of our lives. If we use our lives for his sake, for the sake of the good news, incorporating all the good news, you know, that we have, then we will ensure that our lives count forever and are everlastingly profitable. Now, before we get into the entire passage and verses, I'm going to spend a little bit more time just on verse 9 and looking at the background, perhaps, of usage of the key words and the key word and expression in this passage. First of all, the whole matter of the word soul itself, or life, there's a field of meaning in its usage that I partially perhaps suggest here. It can mean simply the whole person. For example, after Peter's preaching on the day of Pentecost, we're told that many believed. And the Jews then, you know, were baptized then, and everything in accordance with the promise to Israel, you know, as a nation. And they were told that day 3,000 lives, 3,000 souls were added to their number. And that is the worshiping community, you know, that began with the 120 and now expanded, I guess, to 3,120 or thereabouts, rounded off. But 3,000 people is simply, you know, what it means. Or here in the book of 1 Peter, the word soul is also used one time with this sense, and Bob in his message, you know, mentioned that. 8 souls were saved on the ark, right? And there again, it just means 8 people, you know, 8 lives. There are 8 people, the whole person. It also can mean simply the inner self. For example, in the Garden of Gethsemane, in Matthew 26, verse 38, Jesus says, my soul is exceedingly, you know, anguished there. So his inner person anticipating, again, this great suffering, you know, to come. He was greatly moved in his inner person. Now, on the opposite end of the spectrum, when Mary received the news that she would have a child, you know, by the Holy Spirit, in essence, you know, there in her song, then she says, my soul magnifies the Lord. You know, my life magnifies the Lord. Her whole inner self rejoicing and magnifying and worshiping God. It also can simply mean the physical life itself. And Jesus used that in referring to himself. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life for many. And then also, he's a good shepherd who gives up his life, you know, for the sheep. So probably in the sense of physical life here, probably extending much beyond that too, but beginning there. Then it can simply mean the everlasting value of one's life. And that's how certainly it's used in Luke 14, verses 25 to 35, and those other passages too, about in the context of discipleship to the Lord. But then we come also to 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 9. And it's in that sense, and perhaps even in a greater sense, it's kind of an extended metaphor, continuing with how Jesus used it. An everlasting value of one's life. So that's just the word soul itself, but then we make it looking at the expression to save your soul, the salvation of your souls, and save the soul. On a literal level, again, it simply can mean one's physical life. James uses it in that sense at the beginning of his letter and at the end, you know, concerning the possibility of a believer losing his physical life, you know, because of the effects of sin, and save one's physical life from that temporal judgment is in James. It also can mean this: to save the things of value associated with one's life of discipleship. And I've given you already, you know, the many passages that uses it in that sense. But then on an extended metaphorical level, it means to preserve one's life work of faith as an inheritance in heaven. And that's how we're going to see its use as it develops through this prologue of 1 Peter. So, to summarize all of that together, we should not understand the salvation of the soul soteriologically in the sense of receiving everlasting life. But to borrow a word from Marty Cawley, mystologically, in terms of rewards, in essence, obtain. Receiving rewards for discipleship and for commitment while suffering in our identification with Christ as we make our life through this adulterous and sinful generation. So there's a continuity between our life experience in this life and our experience in the life to come. And I want to focus a little bit too on some of the other statements, the words used in this verse. Receiving as the outcome of your faith, salvation. Soul salvation or salvation of your soul. And the word komizo has that sense of receiving something that is due, something that is a reward, to be repaid for an investment that is made. And that's how Bill Mounts, he gives two references used in 1 Peter about that, and then another familiar verse for us in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10. But to observe that this expression to receive something, to be as a repayment, actually is used in the prologue and then in the epilogue of the letter. In the epilogue, it's chapter 5, verse 4, in reference to the elders that are to properly take care of what's entrusted to them in the household of God. When the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the glorious crown that will not tarnish. And the word tarnish here is also repeated from the prologue. So we see the concept bracketing, in essence, the letter of 1 Peter. And then 2 Corinthians 5:10, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ so that each one may be repaid according to what he has done while in the body, whether good or bad. And then the word itself, telos, which can be used in various ways to simply mean the end of something, or perhaps the result, or the outcome, or the finish, or the goal. And my preference here is really the outcome. You know, the outcome of our faith lived here, you know, can be honor and glory and praise before the Lord when we come before him. That the salvation of the soul is the controlling idea of 1 Peter. And this is a chart that I've tried to reproduce the best as I can. And it really was from a chart that I received in class that I took by Zane Hodges. It was my only class while I was at Dallas Seminary in the fall of my graduating year that a friend said, hey, look, Zane Hodges is teaching a class. You really need to take him. And I did. And the class was 1st and 2nd Peter and Jude. And I have the original notes, from that class too. But he gave out, a diagram that is somewhat, like this to see the salvation of the soul as a controlling idea of 1st Peter and how it is that we gain the salvation of our lives. And there's four main ideas, categories, and under those categories, of course, there are some subsections, and that will be in keeping with what Bob Wine said, 17 subsections that can be organized under these four major ideas. We save our souls by developing a holy relationship with God. We ought to be holy as he is holy. And then it goes on to the next area. You know, we have our relationship with the Father. And what's the next level of our relationship that's vital? You know, our relationship with the children of God, with the household, of faith. So we save our souls by fervently loving the church from the heart. And then we save our souls by maintaining a pure and submissive life in the world. We ought to keep ourselves pure and then also submissive, to the proper authorities. And again, we've had other messages on that. But the last and the major, section concerns the whole area of suffering. We save our souls by sharing in Christ's experience of suffering unjustly, even for identification with him. And when he says that we're to walk in his steps, that's what it means. Walking in his steps of suffering and suffering righteously on our part, not for doing evil or such, and not even reviling in return, when we're reviled or we're abused too. So that involves then the salvation of our soul. So the purpose of, and here's another way, in fact, as I was working with the different ways I could diagram something, actually this is the one I think that really illustrates it well. We begin again with our relationship with God, our Father, and that extends to the church, to the world, and to the whole matter of identifying with him in suffering at times unjustly. So this is the prologue, and we're going to see also it focuses intensely on the matter of inheritance and of glory as well. So overall for the prologue itself, this is kind of my summarized statement for the prologue. We secure a glorious inheritance in the life to come by the refining of our faith in this life. And then we have three basic sections concerning that. Verses 3-5, our new birth has set before us the hope of a glorious inheritance in the life to come. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled, and that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you, who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. Now, I have a little bit of an illustration here that I'm only using it to focus on one point. But it's an illustration that has been used by hundreds of pastors, you know, through the years. And you see, it's a brief story. I tried to chase it down to see if I could get an exact historical statement on where and when and how it was used. And I never could find one other than just pastors using it, you know, as a story. But at the same time, I didn't find anyone who tried to debunk the story. But for my purpose, just for one aspect, I think it's a good story. As it goes, during the Napoleonic War, there was a strategic battle in one of the ways that it stated there was on the English Channel. Perhaps it was at Waterloo. No, I'm not completely sure. But the people of England were told to line the cliffs of Dover as they tried to look out upon the waters to see how did it go. And it could have been by the use of semaphores, flashing lights, you know, a brief statement like a telegram, you know, could be sent across, in essence, the channel. So the English semaphores began flashing with the message that was relayed across the waters: Wellington defeated. And suddenly, a deep fog rolled up and cut off the vision of the people. A fog likewise rose in their hearts, and they went back to their homes and shops and began preparing for what they thought was defeat. A few hours later, however, the fog lifted, and the English people were able to see the message clearly. Wellington defeated the enemy. And their spirit revived. They began to rejoice greatly. A defeat of an enemy, a better future possible. And the world, with its trials and tribulations, have a way of rolling in and clouding our perspective on life. And I think verses 3 through 5 really lifts the fog out of the present for us, the present passing world, by giving us a picture of what might await us because of the resurrection of Christ and also the new life that we can live. In fact, the great resurrection chapter of 1 Corinthians 15, ties, you know, the resurrection to our present work of faith in the vanity and the emptiness of this world. Verse 58, 1 Corinthians 15, therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your toil is not in vain. That's the impact of the resurrection, you know, for us. And I think that's what we see also in this passage. There, the world, again, with its trials and tribulations, can cloud us. But we begin chapter 3, verse, the first part of it. God has given us a new birth. We have been born again. We know for certain that we're going to be forever with Christ. And that new birth brings a new hope for us. We're begotten again to a living hope. The resurrection of Christ makes it possible for us to have a living hope, a glorious future. Our hope is alive because Christ is alive. It's living, meaning that our hope is certain, it's sure, it's real, as opposed to the deceptive, empty, false hope that the world offers. So it's a trust, a confidence in God's promises. And what we can particularly anticipate is an inheritance, a promised inheritance from a living hope that we have. We're told that our hope consists of an utterly safe inheritance. Peter calls our hope here an inheritance. An inheritance is the reward that we obtain as the outcome of our faith. Again, through all the trials and tribulations that we may go through. In verses 5, 9, and 10 call, I think, this inheritance salvation. I think that's partly, you know, what the meaning of it there is. And not the description of this inheritance. It's unlike any earthly inheritance. Peter uses three adjectives here, and I'm going to put them up because I like, you know, word plays and assonance and words and how they are in the scriptures and structure and all of that. And here, you know, we're told, and I'm not going to pronounce them properly, I don't know, but I'll give it a try. It's aftarton, amionton, amawanton. And note, you know, it's alliterative, first of all, and also the endings, you know, it's alliterative on both ends, you know, of each word. And also there's a assonance, how it sounds, you know, as you go. So that brings us attention to it. And then that one, amawanton, is used in the epilogue, you know, concerning the glorious crown, you know, that awaits us, that is also faultless in essence. So in English, we might try to say it this way. This inheritance is not liable to destruction, to defilement, or to decay. It is flawless. It is faultless. It is fadeless. It is imperishable in its substance, unstained in its purity, unfading in its beauty. And it's one that awaits us. And we secure this inheritance by remaining under God's protective power. I think that's the one, verse 5. And God provides this protective power to enable us to go in the here and now faithfully, so we do accumulate this incredible inheritance that awaits us. And here again, it's used in the sense of a protective sense, a military sense, to protection along a difficult and dangerous route. You know, God is with us. Well, as Jesus would say, I am with you always. And they're used for Joshua and used for us, even in Hebrews 13, 5, concerning the cares of this life and wealth and all of that. Not that we'd be worried about all that, for he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. And that implies that Christ had said that to Joshua, you know, back in Joshua chapter 1, you know, as well. We have to move along. So protection, salvation, the key word here. And as we continue on, verses 6 and 7, it is the hope of our inheritance that enables us to refine our faith through the endurance of the trials of this life. And here's something these verses this segment begins with the matter of rejoice and repeats it again, you know, at the end of the little segment, joy and rejoice. So in the midst of whatever we suffer, whatever losses that we experience, there can't be an underlying joy that we can experience and go through. And go through the tests and trials of this life, the trials and tribulations. Trials might be the simple matters that we experience because of the vanity of the world in which we live. The tribulations might be what is brought on to us, you know, by whatever opposition and that we encounter also. But concerning those trials, we're told several things. Trials do not last forever. They are just now for a little while. Trials come if need be. Trials are painful. They grieve us. I'm profoundly grieved in my soul, he said. Trials are varied. They come in a variety of forms and colors. They're different at different times for us, for different ones of us. But they are meant for our spiritual profit. And again, we see this emphasized through this. Part of that profit is future praise and honor and glory that awaits the believer who endures trials in faith. And we're told that our purified faith is more precious than purified gold. And I think John referred to the cover of one of Zane's books on James. I had a similar image also on that. And again, this is a little story. Again, I don't know whether that was actually made by statement, but again, I found it helpful. The story of a man who was visiting a gold processing center and became very interested in watching the goldsmith purify the gold by heating it in a large vat. And finally, he asked the goldsmith how he knew when the gold had been heated enough so that all the impurities were gone. And his reply, when I can see my face clearly reflected in the gold. And part of the use of trials of the Lord to us is to render us to be more and more like him in our character and in all. And that takes a refinement process, a purifying process, taking away the dross and so forth. And if we come approved, through all of that, the point is to examine us, to bring us to a point of approval, in essence, results in praise and honor and glory at the judgment seat of Christ when the time comes. Finally, our refined faith results in a greater intimacy with Christ in the present life and a glorious inheritance in the life to come. So concerning Christ, it's verse 8, concerning Christ, whom you, having not seen, you love. Though now you do not see him, yet believing, you rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, and then receiving the end of your faith, the salvation of your souls. And there's great interest, in fact, we're told, in this. We're told that the prophets, of course, were trying to look forward, wanted to be part of the coming of Christ, his suffering and the glory to follow, and all in. And we have seen that. The apostles certainly saw that, and the apostles proclaimed that to us, and we can enter into that fellowship and so experience an intimacy with Christ and with the apostolic community and beyond, the church founded upon them and Christ being the cornerstones. But in that, we're to trace his steps for us. He's that example for us. And in doing so, we save our lives. We save our souls. We accumulate an inheritance in heaven that's ultimately unfading. And then that promise made to the elders who are faithful in chapter 5, the crown of glory. So it's, I think, the implication of ruling with Christ if we continue on, to the end of life, faithful to him. You can save your and Bob confused me on the pronunciation, of the term. but you still can, not your fig tree, but your life in God, church, the world, suffering. And here's another statement. And the first statement, from C.T. Studd, In fact, I think we're doing a podcast, you know, Ken and Bob and I. And I asked them in that, you know, to identify who said what. And they, when I gave the CT stud statement, you know, only one life will soon be lost. Only what's done for life will last. Guess who they guessed for that one? Jim Elliot. Right. Exactly. So we all think it's Jim Elliot. But Jim Elliot had a statement, and this is from his journal that was published, actually. And I read it when I was in college, you know, and the great statement, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain that which he cannot lose." And what did he give? Of course, he and the four others, Nate Sense and everything, you know, they were killed by the Aka Indians as they were trying to establish communication, you know, with them. But if you know the rest of the story, it's an incredible story concerning that tribe and everything that happened subsequently. And I think it was the wife of Nate Sent who went back, you know, to share with that tribe and begin the process of seeing one by one them coming to believe in Christ for everlasting life. But we'll come back to Sitsi Stud. Only one life, it will soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last. So save your suke too. Make your life count forever. Yeah.
Hello.
No time for questions?
We do. We have a few minutes, and while y'all are writing those up, I just want to make a quick couple announcements. First, is Letitia here? Is she in here? Thanks. All right. Well, then, sorry, Steve. Also, I wanted to say, the young adults, we are going to go out to Panera as a group. So if you would like to join, we're meeting at the lobby at 5:30 for dinner to go and just hang out and kind of fellowship. So young adults, join us in the lobby at 5:30, and we're all going to go out and have dinner and hang out. Also, I wanted to just highlight, we're about to break for lunch, but tonight there will be a time where Diane Boring is going to lead a worship at 7. And I just wanted to highlight that because I think it's going to be a really sweet time of fellowship and singing with her. So, all right, with that, let's look at these questions, these hard-hitting questions. Can you please explain the phrase in 1 Peter 1:3, caused, underline, us to be born again? It sounds Calvinistic.
I think the Trinity basically is involved in different ways, you know, with us coming to regeneration, being born again. You know, we're born certainly by the Spirit, and here it's the, you know, we're told it's according to the abundant mercy of the Father. You know, that's possible. So I don't think it's pointing to the fact that he caused us. He is the one that chose us to the exclusion of others, mm-hmm. you know, but simply that he's the agent also. It's according to his mercy.
All right. This next question is basically asking, what happens to a believer who is faithful during maybe the first half of their life but then fails in their second half? Will they still receive the rewards that they earned in the first half?
Okay, good. Very good question. Of course, the passage does talk about an accumulation, you know, of this inheritance. So there's one facet of it, which is we're rewarded, you know, for things that as we do them. You know, too, there's an account, you know, that's being increased, you know, in heaven. But when we tie it in to chapter 5, verse 4, there it talks about a crown, an unfading crown. And I think GS distinguishes, you know, between rewards that are immediately gained and kept, and the crown, the ruling with Christ, is someone who endures faithfully, you know, in life, you know, too. So the unfading crown, I think, is a special one, too, for the faithfulness in this case here, specifically of elders.
You know, and just a quick one on that. I remember when I first went to Victor Street Bible Chapel, I held the view that if you serve Christ faithfully for, say, 50 years and you fell away in the last year, well, you were going to rule and reign with Christ, but you'd lose a city or something. And then I got there, and Hodges was like, no, if we endure, we will reign with him. He who overcomes and keeps my works to the telos, the end, is going to get authority over the nations. And so we get to keep the instant winners, laying up treasure in heaven, but the hidden manna, the special white garments, that special white stone, the right to the tree of life, ruling with Christ, all those things require perseverance.
Isn't that the point of Hebrews? I mean, the readers of Hebrews have suffered. They've experienced
right.
these things, and he's spurring them on to continue, because if they don't, they will lose the right to be metikoi in the kingdom to come.
Yes, metikoi partners. And by the way, quick funny story, Philippe.
Yes.
Because, you know, he talks it.
You
talk.
Pick up my time. That's yeah, fine.
So, you know, you had those three alpha words, right?
Yes.
And what were your three D's, by the way? They were good. What were...
I have to look back again.
You look back. But I spent a week with Josh McDowell when he was at Marshall University. I got a chance to spend a week with him while I was on staff with Crew. And I happened to mention how beautiful 1 Peter 1, is it verse 4, where it says, we have an inheritance which is imperishable, undefiled, will not fade away.
Yeah, destruction, defilement, or decay, not subject.
Destruction, defilement, decay. So if you switch it from alpha to delta, there is what you get. But you know what Josh McDowell said to me? He said, yes, but you know how Arminians would say, because it says, who are kept through the power of God through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last times. He said, they're going to say you got to continue in faith. And you know what? He got it right. It's just we were dealing with the wrong inheritance.